February 10th, 1999, and we are on where?
Embal Hamid Base, otherwise known as 46B.
46B. Okay.
Okay. All right. We are in the midst of discussing the ritual of the Egla Rufa, and we've reached a point already where they've already measured and determined which city is closest to it. The elders of the city now have made their declaration, you know, that Yodeinu lo shokas hadom azev yenel ro'ru, right, and so on and so forth. And not only that, but you know, they've already done the job, you know, of slaughtering it. Why is it called Egaru? Because they take a hatchet or a big knife and then they cut it from the back over there, because this is the aura, this is the back, okay? Or the neck, okay? So this is the aura. So that's what they did, all right? And now they go into a discussion about, you know, why is it that the elders have to make the declaration that they did, namely, Yodeinu lo shokas hadom hazeh. We've already seen in the Mishnah, says, how would we even imagine that the elders would be murderers, you know, that they say our hands did not shed this blood. But maybe they failed this person in various ways. Maybe they sent him away from their town without ever giving him food when he needed it. Or maybe they failed to accompany him on the way, because after all, the road might be filled with dangers. And this way, if they had accompanied him, then they would have avoided, would have enabled him, you know, to escape his fate, which was, of course, to be murdered. So this is what they are now talking about. All right, so I'll start from, you see where the big line is over there.
Right.
Okay. So we'll start on the third line over there, which says, Zikneh Hirochs Nideh. Okay? All right, so it's Tana Rabbanan. Sages have taught as follows. It says, V'chol zikne ho'yir ha'hi ha'kron melech ha'lo yechatsu zideihem al v'eglar ruha banocha. Right. In other words, they quote the Pasuk from the Torah, which speaks with the story of, you know, what happens after they have slaughtered the, you know, the heifer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it says over there, and all the elders of that city who are close to the slain person, they are to wash their hands over the heifer which was slain in this nachal, in this stream, okay, or this valley. So he says, Shein Talmud Lema Ha'arufo, says, why does the Talmud use the word Ha'arufo, right? Ma Talmud Lema Ha'arufo, so why does it say? So the answer is, one answer that they give is, Al-Makot Ha'arufo Social Eglon, okay? In other words, that they have to put their hands on the place where, now I can interpret it in one of two different ways. One way is that we're talking about that they do it in the area, you know, the makom, where the animal has been slain, as a kapara, of course, you know, is the comment. Or maybe it means that they have to wash their hands right after they have slain the animal and do it, you know, maybe mix the water with the blood or something like that, which is also a possibility, okay? The Omru, and they have to say, Yodeinu lo shokas hadom hazeh, right? Our hands did not shed this blood, the Anin Ra'u, and our eyes did not see. V'chi alibeinu also shebezdin shokim damim. Can we even imagine that members of the Bezdin are murderers? Ela lo bo li Yodeinu fatmenuho, v'loim izonus, but perhaps he did not come to us that we sent him away without any food. V'lo re'inuhu, nor did we see him, and we let him go without escorting him, without accompanying him, you know, on his way. So this leads now to a discussion of the mitzvah of escorting people on the way. Tanya, we have a teaching which says, Hoya Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Meir, the Rabbi Meir would say, Kofin Lulaboya. He says, a community can compel people to escort people. Just as, in other words, as it's the mitzvah, let's say, to give tzedakah, and the community can compel people that they should have to contribute to a tzedakah. So, the same thing, they can also compel people that they should serve as escorts in order to see to it that people who come and leave the town, you know, are escorted in safety. And not only that, but the Sheikh says, Sechah halboya ein lo shir, that the reward for accompanying somebody, you can't even begin to measure how great is the reward. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, and now they're going to quote. Okay, first of all, they quote a story that we find actually in the very first chapter of the book of Judges, where it says over there that, you know, the people of Israel started in the conquest of the land, and here they come to a place and they don't know how to conquer it, right? So it's written over there, Vayira HaShomrim Yishotzei Min Hoyir. The guards, meaning, of course, you know, the people who were, you know, the vanguard or something like that, you know, they saw a man going out of the city, Vayomru Lo, and they said unto him, Harenu Noas Mevo Hoyir, show us what is the entrance to the city. Yosinu Im Kol Chesed, and we will show favor unto you. Uksiv, and then it's written, Vayarem Es Mevo Hoyir, right, that he showed them the entrance to the city. And what is the favor that they showed unto him? What was the kindness that they showed him? Right? That all the inhabitants of that city they slew in order to conquer it. But that man and his family they set free. And then what did that man do? It's written by Yelech HaYish, then that man went Eretz HaChitin, he went to the land of the Hittites, because there were some Hittites still living in Eretz Israel at that time. Remember, we say HaChiti, HaGor, HaPrizai, Guzi, and so on. So there were some Hittites living over there, and of course we know that who did Abraham Avinu have to do business with when he needed a keva for his wife? Ephron HaChiti, right? They were the B'nai Ches, you see. So there was an area over there around Hebron where they lived, okay? So this man went to the land of the Hittites, Vayivin Ir, and he built a city over there. Vayikro Shemo Luz. And he called it Luz. Hushmada Yomazeh. And this city bears his name to this very day. Tanya, we have another tradition which says, He Luz. This is Luz, the very same Luz, Shetzovim Bot Chelis. Shetzovim Bot Chelis. So this is the same Luz in which they dye the Techelis. The Techelis, if you remember, I mean, when we say every day, you know, when we say Krishna, we say, right, that you are to make fringes, accompany them, and so on. Then it says, Vinosnu al Tzitzis Hakonov, Pesil Techelis. Included in the corner, you have to have a thread of Techelis, which is dyed with this, you know, this special purple dye, okay? Bluish, purple, whatever it is. According to one tradition, it's bluish, because it's supposed to look like the color of the sky reflected in the sea.
But the tzitzis are not.
We don't have it today. Why don't we have it today? For a very good reason. Because, unfortunately, it became a monopoly in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, that there was a family who specialized in the dyeing of the techelis. And when the Romans destroyed Eretz Yisrael, so they killed off the members of this family, and there's no one left in order to rule. And these people, they never wanted to share with others the secret for doing it, right? It's a Gemara that criticizes several different families because they had monopolies and they never wanted to share their knowledge with others. Whereas the idea of Torah is, I mean, Torah has to be shared with people. And that would also apply to these things. I don't know how this would fit in today's business world, you know. But nevertheless, right. But the sentiment in the Gemara really is that if you have the knowledge, share it with
others.
Don't keep it just to yourself.
Each share the secret and they share the profits.
Right. Okay. But at any rate, Luz was a place where they dyed the tailors, okay, the tzitzis and with this purple dye so that it could be used. Okay. He Luz, Shebo Sancheveno Bilbelot. This is the same Luz where Sancheirov came, and yet he was unable to literally to mix up the inhabitants of it. Now this goes back to a Gemara that we find a couple of places in the Talmud, which speaks about the fact, if you remember, that Torah says that an Ammoni and a Moavi, in other words, an Ammonite, a Moabite, are not allowed to marry a Jewish person. Okay? And not only does it say that, but also says, even within the 10th generation, they cannot marry. With the Egyptians and with the Edomites, there's a more lenient. They're the third generation. Could already intermarry with Jews, okay? But not the 10th generation of the Ammoni or the Moabi, okay? So the question is, how, maybe today, somebody who wants to convert to Yiddishkeit might be a descendant of the Ammonim or the Moabim. How do we know, how far back the ancestry goes or anything like that? So the Gemara answers and it says, look, when Sancheirov came, Sancheirov in English we call him Sennacherib, okay? He was the king of Assyria and he conquered a good deal of Eretz Yisrael, okay? Including, the 10 tribes, the area of the 10 tribes, so he conquered all that, okay? So it says that when he came with his conquest, he mixed up all the nations because the policy of the Assyrians was that they would schlep in people from other areas and take the captive nation that they had conquered and ship them off someplace else. This is the reason why the 10 tribes were pushed off, who knows, to all of the uttermost reaches of the Assyrian Empire, so that they became lost as far as we're concerned, except in legends and so on, right? But on the other hand, he took nations from other areas and he put it into the territory that he had conquered, and they became what we call the Samaritans, the Shamronim, because they were a Goyim who adopted some Jewish practices, but not completely, okay? So, as a result, we say that Sancheirov did a favor to all the Goyim in that he mixed them all up so that we don't know to this day, and therefore it became a dead letter, so to speak, okay? So therefore, any goy today who wants to come and become a Jew, he does not have to prove his ancestry, that he's not an Ammonite or a Moabite, okay? By the way, according to the Gemara, that applied only to the male Ammonites and Moabites. It did not apply to the female. Why didn't it apply? Because after all, who was Ruth? She was a Moabiyah. She was a Moabite woman, right? So that therefore they give a drash, it says Ammoni, below Ammonis, right? And Moabi, but not Moabiyah. Okay. In other words, it doesn't apply to the
Moabite.
Okay. All right. So, what about Luz? Apparently, this is one city that Sancheirov was never able to conquer, and so presumably it remained in its purity. But I'm talking about Jewish purity. Okay. All right. At any rate, he was never able to come and to mix it up with any others. Okay. Then,
you're talking about the Jewish inhabitants of that town.
Yeah, right. And then, one step even further, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, because he conquered, what remained of the kingdom of Yehuda, of Judah, right? Below Echrivon. And not only that, but he was unable to destroy this city. The Yaf Malach HaMoves in the Rishus Lavrobo. And even the Malach HaMoves has no authority to pass within this city. He's out of a job when it comes to the city of Lewis. However, what happens? After all, people do die. So he says, Elah Zakenim Shabor, the elderly people in Lewis, right? This man Shadatan Kotso, when they're fed up with life already, you know, they had enough of it, and they figure it's time to go. So in that particular case, right? So Yotzin Chusnachoma, they go outside of the wall of the city, and that's where they die. Now, getting back to the idea about escorting, right? They say, "Lo devarim kal v'chomer." Certainly, we can draw an inference, you know, a kal v'chomer from the story about this Canaanite, the man who showed them the way into the town. Says, "Amar Kanani zeh," take a look, this Canaanite, because he was a Kanani, right? "Shelo diber b'fiv." Nowhere does it mention that he said anything to them. He didn't even say anything to them. "Below holach v'raglo," nor did he walk in order to show them. But nevertheless, goram atzol alo zarad sokel atoros, still, by his action, he brought to himself and to his generation, to his seed, and, you know, to all future generations, he was able to save them. So Misha is the boy of Iraglo. Somebody actually takes the trouble to walk with somebody and escort somebody. Alachatz kama v'chaba. So much more can we expect that the Rebbe Shalom will reward them, for performing this mitzvah. Okay. Which is part of hospitality, obviously. Hospitality is more, in other words, than simply welcoming somebody into your house and feeding him, clothing him, whatever it may be, but it also involves seeing that he's able to go on his way safely as well. Okay. They could pass an ordinance. That's what I mean. They could make an ordinance that people should be, either that, you know, that people should out of their own goodwill do it, or maybe they could appoint some people whose special job it was in order to go and to escort people, just to be sure. Just as we have a police force, let's say, today, that's supposed to protect people. So that they possibly could have ordained, you know, that for the local area, that they would do the same thing. Now, so getting back to this person, it says, "Bameh Harolehem." How did he show them the entrance to the city if he didn't say anything, right? So Chizkiya says, "Befiv Otam Lehem." He sort of twisted his mouth in order to show them, you know, something like that. To show them
the way. That away.
Right. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, he says, "The etzboi herolehem," that he pointed with his finger to them. How to get? Okay. Now, Tanya Kavose de Rabbi Yochanan, we have learned a teaching which agrees with this statement of Rabbi Yochanan that says, "Bishvil shekanani ze hero be'etzboro," because this Canaanite showed them with his finger, so goram hatzod alo zorat zokel adonis. He was able to secure rescue for himself, safety for himself and for his descendants to the end of all times. Okay? Alright. So we're still on the subject now of Levaya, in the sense not going to a funeral, although that's something, because that is what? That's called Havaya Sameis. In other words, it's escorting the dead to the burial place. That's how the word, got its word, got its meaning. Okay? But Levaya in general over here in the Gemara means escorting people. The Lavot, right? To accompany somebody.
Some people walk right after the hearse after it's...
Absolutely, right. I mean, if you can't go to the funeral, then at least, you know, make a sign that you go at least for four steps or something like that. Right. Correct.
Was the concept of the baby there?
Luz?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right, right, right. Okay. I mean, obviously, it's a very nice story and so on, but
you know, but they were
right.
Making this point, so did they know was it true?
Could be. I think so. It's a matter of faith.
Okay. But that was a place where they actually died in the Chalas. This is no question. I mean, but the other things is sort of in the realm of Agada, but it could be a grain of truth. Okay.
Okay. So we're still on the subject of the meaning of the word, right? Omer Rav Yoshua ben Levi, Hamhalech Baderach, somebody goes on the way, Ve'ein Bo Levaya, and he doesn't have somebody to go together with him to escort him, then in that case, obviously, he's putting himself in danger. How can he escape danger? The answer is Yasok BaTorah. Then let him think about words of Torah. Let him engage in Torah. Shenemar, because there's a pasuk in Mishlei which says Ki Livyas Chein Heim LeRoshecha Anoch Gagor Yisecha, which literally means because they are like a chaplet. In other words, like a wreath or something that you put on the head, right, of the grace unto him, that is, and also is like beads for your neck. Okay, in other words, like jewels for your neck. In other words, the Torah is like a precious ornament. But you notice that the word that they're using over here, which I translated as chaplet, is livyas. Now, obviously, it's from the same thing. Why? Because, in other words, it's sort of like it escorts the head or something like that. So that's how they get the derivation of the word. Okay. The other of you, and of course, we're talking, as I said over there, about Torah, about wisdom. This is what it gets. The Yom Rabbi Yishuv Ben Levi, another statement of him. Bishvil arbo psiyos sheliva paro le'Abraham, because of the four steps that Pharaoh escorted Abraham, shenemar, as is written by Yitzav Olov paro anoshim, that Pharaoh ordered that people should go together with Abraham. So there were four words over here. Then nishtabed bevonov abba miyoshona. This is why he merited, so to speak, he was rewarded by the fact that the descendants of Abraham would have to serve Pharaoh for 400 years. Shenema v'avodomi inuaisema v'amirshona. As the pasuk says, that, you know, this was, if you remember, this was in the Brisbane of Sora. This is when Abraham had a vision of God, and he heard God say that, you know, your descendants will be in the land, not their own, right? And they will serve them, and they will be tormented, in other words, they will be persecuted for 400 years. And of course, this was fulfilled in the slavery of the Jewish people afterwards. All right. Of course, that brings, you know, the question, you know, 400 years, right?
They didn't stand it.
But they weren't there, I mean, exactly for, I mean, they were. So how do you count the 400 years? Because altogether, according to another tradition, the people of Israel were in Egypt a total of 210 years. So the answer is that because the Shibut, in other words, the slavery begins already with the Brisbane Absorim, even though the Jews were not physically in the land of Egypt, but the very fact that there was already an intimation of exile for the Jewish people, so is already an indication, you know, that this is like a form of slavery. Right, exactly. Okay. Omer Yehuda Omer Rav, Kol Hamalaves Chaveru Arba Amos Be'ir Eino Nisam, says if a person takes the trouble to escort somebody else, even for 4 cubits, in other words, what? Go 6 feet with him in the city, so Eino Nizor, he will not come to any harm. And they bring the case of Rabino Oviel Rava by Yitzchok Dalet Amos, that Ravina escorted Rabbi Bar Yitzchak before Amos Be'ir in the city. Moto Liodei Ezeko, and something, a danger suddenly appeared before him, but he was saved from it by virtue of the fact that he had fulfilled the mitzvah of escorting even the minimum of four amos. Tanurabonim, our sages taught along the same lines that Harav Natalmid Adibura Shalkia. If the teacher is escorting his student, then in that case he should escort him to the Iburo Shalir. The question is, what is Iburo? Literally, the place where the city becomes pregnant. In other words, this is where the houses of the city first begin appearing, you know, clustered together. In other words, escort him to where you have, so to speak, the last housing development in the city. Okay? Chover lechover. What if it's one Talmud Chochem is escorting another Talmud Chochem? Then in that case, at Chum Shabbos, he should escort him even further, as far as the Chum Shabbos, because in other words, the first one would be just as far as, let's say, you know, the last house. But this is already 2,000 amos away beyond that. Right. Okay? If it is Talmud Lerav, but what if it is a student who is escorting his teacher, then in that case, ein lo shiur, right? Then there is no fixed amount, but obviously it would be even greater, right? So now they try to define how much greater, the chama, what distance. So Omar Rav Sheshes, Rav Sheshes said, ad parsa. A student should escort his master, his teacher, even as far as a parsa. Parsa in English is called a parasang. Actually, it's a Greek version of a Persian word, okay? And what it meant is that this is the equivalent of 4 miles. Of course, when I say miles, I don't mean American miles, I mean Roman miles, which is the measurement that they used back in those days. How do we get the word mile? From Latin. In Latin it says mille passum, in other words, 1,000
steps,
right. So that is a mile.
Paces.
Miles and paces, exactly. Question is only whose paces? So they figured that this was probably the pace that the average Roman soldier would be able to walk, you know, when he was marching over there. So that's how they determined the original idea of a mile. It's a little bit shorter. Not quite as long. Maybe it's 5,000 feet instead of, 5,280. Okay? Approximately that. As I say, approximately. I don't know whether anybody actually ever took, measured it, you know, exactly for the inch or something. But it's approximately. Okay. So he should go as far as a parasang, okay? I studied Greek once upon a time. That's where I came across the word parasang. There's a guy by the name of Xenophon.
Xenophon,
the Anabasis, okay? It's a story about Greek soldiers hired by Cyrus. They were like mercenaries, okay? Members of his guard, and then Cyrus was slain afterwards, was assassinated. So they had a march all the way through Asia Minor until they finally got to the sea, where they were able to find a boat and get back to Greece again. So every at the end of every march, you know, it's how many parasites they traveled and so on. Memories of another misspent childhood. Studying back to Greek.
That is very well misspent.
Okay. Anyway, okay, so he says, as far as a parson, as far as a parasite, below Amoron Ela Rabo Shenemufak. But now we're talking only if a student accompanies his rabbi who is not his Rabo Mufak. The Rabo Mufak means that he is the outstanding, the primary source of instruction. This is a great rabbi, a great teacher, but he's not the one from whom he learned most of his Torah, so to speak. About Rabbo Mufhok, but if it is his Rabbo Mufhok, then in that case he should accompany him even shlosha parsois, right? Even three parasines, which of course would be the equivalent, as we said before, of 12 miles. Okay. Rav Kano uviyal Rav Shimi Barashi nipumnara beitz nisan de Babel. Rav Kano accompanied Rav Shimi ben Ashi from the town of Pum Nahara, which of course in Arabic obviously means the mouth of the river. Of course, in other words, this is where probably the Euphrates empties into something else. Okay, as far as Beit Sanisa in Babylonia. Okay, now Beit Sanisa would mean actually the house where you have all kinds of palm trees. In other words, the area where there are many palm trees grow. Kimoto Hosam, when they got over there, and obviously it was a great, great distance that he accompanied him, right? Now that's the whole point of the story. But we have another story, another point. Omalei, so he said to him, Vadai da amritu hanitzinisa de bovel mishnei odomarish of Yisnevel. It says, you probably heard that these palm trees of Babylonia that grow over here in Sinisa de bovel, they date back yet to the years of Adam HaRishon. Okay, in other words, he planted them a long time ago. So Amalei, so he said to him, Adchaton Milsa, you remind me now of a word the Omar Rabbi Yosef Abchanido, namely my dechsir. What is the meaning of the pasuk that we have in Jeremiah where it says Be'eretz lo ovar bo yish v'lo yoshav Adam sham? Jeremiah over there was talking about the love of God and the people of Israel in the early days of their relationship. And God praises Israel for the fact, if you remember, that they were willing to go into a land where no man had ever trodden, that's the Ovar Bo, below Yoshev Odom Shom, nor did anyone ever live over there. Okay? V'chim yachosh li'ovar. So Gemara asks the logical question, if nobody ever trod there, so Heichen Yoshev, so how could it be a place where nobody's, where no one settled to? Elo, but it teaches us what? Eretz shegozo aneho odom harishon, the Yishuv, if Adam said, this is a place that is going to be settled, then in that case, this Yashva Eretz, and that land became settled. Shenogazar neho Adam HaRishon, but if it's an area which Adam HaRishon did not say that this is going to be settled, then in that case, lo nisyashva. It was not settled. Okay? Gemara in Sanhedrin speaks about the fact, famous Mishnah, you know, that Adam HaRishon, for example, the dust from which the Rabbeinu Shel Olam fashioned Adam HaRishon was taken from all over the world. So that, you know, nobody would say that the original man, you know, was only, let's say, a Frenchman or a German or an Italian or even a Yid. Okay? He was universal man. So that, therefore, this sort of reinforces the idea to say that, you know, wherever Adam decreed that this is the land that's going to be settled, then in that case, this is what happened, no matter what country it may be. But on the other hand, we know that there are deserts, wildernesses, right, areas that are not settled. So presumably, Adam HaRishon decreed that this is not going to be a settled area. Okay. Rabbi Mordechai, Ilyeh Rav Ashi, he accompanied Rav Ashi, Mehagronia, the Adbe Kefe. These are also areas in Babylonia. Okay? Yeah. Hagronia. Okay? To Be Kefe. Okay? The Amri law, and others say that he accompanied even as far as Ad Beidura, to Beidura. Okay. If you lived in Babylonia, you would know these places. Otherwise, we need a DAA map in order to figure them out, okay? All right. But again, the idea, as I told you, I mean, is to stress the importance of showing respect for somebody else by being willing to escort them on the way when they leave you. Okay? And finally, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, "Bishum Rabbi Meir, Nanim Rabbi Meir, that Kol Sheinu Melave Umis Lave Kilu Shefer Dovim. Whoever does not accompany somebody else, or does not, or is not escorted by somebody else, it's as if blood is being spilled. Why?" And here we come to a different story. Sheinu Mole Livuhu Anshe Yerichon Elisha. Okay.
This brings us to a, it's not a very nice story that we find in Melachim Beis. Okay? It's written in, close to the beginning of Melachim Beis, chapter 4 to be exact, that Elisha came to the town of Yericho. Okay? And the town of Yericho, the water was sort of poisoned, okay? People were not able to drink from this water. So what did he do? He prayed, he threw a stick in the water, and of course what happened? The water became pure, okay? So then he left Yericho on his way. Hardly had he left the area when all of a sudden he was molested by a group of kids. I don't know, I mean, they refer to as being the Arim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say Yelodim, it says Norim. But there's, let's say these are teenagers who came and they were heckling him and they were saying to him, Alei Kereach, Alei Kereach, go get gone, Baldy, go get gone, Baldy, okay? And so Elisha became incensed at how they were treating him, how the lack of respect that they showed for them, and so he cursed them. And lo and behold, suddenly bears came out of the forest, and they attacked these young people, right, and killed them. How many did they kill? They killed 42.
Wow.
Okay. As I say, it's not a very nice story. It doesn't redound to the credit of Elisha. But on the other hand, they're quoting it over here to show what? So this is, we come back to the story over here. Okay? It says that if the people of Yericho had taken the trouble to escort Elisha, then what would have been the result? The kids would not have come and insulted him and abused him and everything
right.
else, and as a result, lo gira dubim latinokas, then he would not have sicked the bears onto these kids. Okay, shenemar. Now they quote the pasuk vayal mishon beisel, that from there, in other words, from the city of Yericho, he went up to Bethel, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean he went to temple over there, but, but he went to the town of Bethel. The who or lo baderech, and he was going up on the road when the orim ketanu yotzim noir, and then these young kids came out of the city by his kalsubo, and they mocked him. Vayomulo, and they said to him, Alei kereach, Alei kereach, go up. In other words, get gone, Baldy, get gone, Baldy. So, Omulo, Alei. Now, why did they say that to him? This is what the Gemara asks. So he says, Sheikrachto, Olenu et Hamokam. Literally, you know why they called him Baldy? Because they said to him, you made bald for us this city. Alright, so. Vos Baintus, as we would say in French. So thank God we have a Rashi. Rashi explains as follows. He says that these people, these youngsters, right, when the water in Yericho was poisoned, so they made a business of selling water that was drinkable to the city, to the inhabitants of the city. But now that Elisha purified the water over there so that now everybody could drink, so they lost their trade, they lost their business. And that's why they were angry with him, and that's why they insulted him, okay?
So now the Gemara asks the following question. Says, my Ne'orim Ketanim, how come that they are called Ne'orim Ketanim? Young kids, you understand? I mean, what is a nar? Nar technically is somebody who is at the age of puberty and going up a little bit, okay? Teenagers, okay? Teenagers. But why do they refer to him as Ketanim? Which would be a contradiction. You understand? Because Ketanim, according to the usage in the Gemara, you know, when you start into the French at different ages, so that you know, for example, let's say education, at what point does a person become responsible for mitzvahs and things like that, and so on, right? So anyone who is below the age of Nar is automatically what? Zakata, or Katana, the feminine, okay? For example, we had, when we studied Kedushin, okay, had the problem of, let's say,
marriage,
and the problem, you know, this week, for example, we'll be reading Parsha Mishpatim, okay? Practically, at the beginning of Mishpatim, we speak about a man who decides to sell his daughter as an omer, right? It's an omer riyah, as a female slave or servant, whatever you want to say, okay? And the master has the opportunity either of marrying her or of setting her free. He could also, by the way, say that he wants her to marry the son. Okay. Alright. But in any case, according to the Gemara, this can only be in the case of a katana. She has to be below the age of 12. At the age of 12 and one day, she becomes a nara, and automatically she gains her freedom if the master has not done anything beyond that. Okay? Now, for marriage purposes too, it's important because the father has authority over the daughter through the time that she is a nara. Okay. But once she becomes 12 and a half, then in that case she is now a gedola. And therefore, at this particular point, she is independent and she is responsible for herself and so on and so forth. Okay? So, as you can see, these terms have a technical importance as far as the Talmud is concerned. So that, therefore, it says Ne'orim Ketanim, it would be a contradiction between the word Ne'orim, which would imply having already reached the age of puberty, as compared to Ketanim, which would be
below that.
Minor, right, lower. Okay? So that, therefore, they give a different interpretation. So, what is the meaning then, Ne'orim Ketanim? So, Omar Rabbi Elazar. We have also said that the word Ne'orim indicates Ne'orim min ha-mitzvos. Okay? That they are literally shaken off from mitzvahs. In other words, these were youngsters, these were kids who did not obey any mitzvahs. Okay? The word Ne'orim, you know, this is related like, for example, when we say the Chodoidi, right? What do we say? Hisnari Be'ofa, right? Of course, actually, it's a quotation from Yeshayahu, but okay, but it means shake off yourself from the dust, okay? So that means that they're shaken off, in other words, removed from mitzvahs. They don't perform them. Ketanim, and how about the word Ketanim? That indicates, show you Miktani Amona, that they were people who had very little faith. How do we know they had very little faith? Because if they had a great deal of faith, they would know that the Rabbeinu Shalom would take care of their needs, so that even if he took away the water monopoly from them, he would provide them with something else, give them a living. But they had no faith in the Rabbeinu Shalom. Okay. Tana, another interpretation. Ne'orim hoyu, right? They were young people, but u'bizbizu atzman kiketanim, which means that they disgraced themselves as if they were kids as if they were young, children. In other words, these were teenagers who should have acted like teenagers, and instead they acted like little children. Moskva for Rabbi Yosef. So Rabbi Yosef attacks this. He has a different theory as to what the meaning of the word Arim means. He says, the Dilmoy says, maybe Al-Shem Mekoma, right, says, maybe they came from a place where the Arim simply means that they are inhabitants of a place called Ne'orah. Okay, take a look and look at Dilmoy says, Ketan Mamish for you, right, maybe they were talking young, very young kids, but Yashem Komenikru, Ne'orim, Shehoyu Min Ne'uran. Next to the last Rashi on the page. There is a place in Yehoshua, in Joshua, where he gives a list of different areas, and there is a place called Ne'uran, which was a city inhabited by Jews. Okay? So he says, maybe they were Take Ketanim, but why are they called Ne'orim? Because the answer is that they came from the town of Ne'uran. Okay. Everybody has his own theory over here, obviously. However, getting back to it, Milo Kasir, don't we find another statement in connection also with Elisha, where it's written by Aram Yatsu Gedudim that the Arameans sent troops by Yishbu Me'eretz Yisrael Narokatano, and they seized as a captive a young girl, Narokatano, from Eretz Yisrael. The Kashalon, again the same Kashalon, how could she be a Na'ara, right, a Na'ara, and at the same time a Katana, since it means the different ages. So, Omar Rapados, and Rapados said, Katano, he says that means the Min Ne'uran, because she must have come from the Ne'uran. So the Gemara says, Hasam loy meforish mekoma. There, in the case of the Ketano, it doesn't really mention what town she came from. It's only a theory that she came from a place, from this place, the Ne'uran. But Hasam meforish mekoma, here we know definitely where did they come from. They didn't come from the Ne'uran, but where did they come from? They came from Yericho, because they resented the loss of their business. So, at any rate, it's not 100% clear, but as you can see, they're struggling with the fact that the two words are next to each other, juxtaposed. Okay. Then, continuing with the story of Elish, it's written by Yifan Acharov that, he turned behind, because they were behind him, they were yelling at him, by Yireim, and he saw them, by Yikal Aleim B'Shem Hashem, and he cursed them in the name of God. So the question is, Mara'ot, what did he see? Why should he curse them so drastically, this thing happened to them? So Omar Rav, so Rav said, Ra'ah Mamosh. He saw, he really took a look at them and he didn't like what he saw. Kiritanya, as we learned in the statement which says, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Omer, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Kol Mokim. Arise, but of course, obviously, it's not what it means. What it means is that wherever they look with very great disapproval at what they see, so it's only so only, then the result is that either the death is going to occur to the person, who is behaving in this terrible way, or at the very least, poverty will come upon them. Okay. And, there are other examples of behind, that the disrespect
shown to it, you know, people actually died.
Okay. All right. Shmuel Omar, Shmuel gave it another interpretation. It says, Ra'ah, what he saw was, Shekulon is Abra Bahen Imam Yom HaKippur, that all of these kids, their mothers became pregnant with them, you know when? On Yom Kippur. Which means what? I mean, we know that Yom Kippur, right? I mean, that we have what we call the Inuyim, you know, the things that we must observe things that we deny to ourselves on Yom Kippur, eating, drinking, but one of the things also is, cohabitation. It's also prohibited. And here, their mothers had no respect for Yom Kippur, and presumably it's not only the mothers, it's the mothers and fathers, obviously. It takes two to tango, you know. So, it does. So, at any rate, these were all people who had obviously cast off Yiddishkeit the way it should be practiced, and so therefore this is what he saw. Rabbi Yitzchak Dabcha, he saw something else. So he said, Omar, Beloris Ra'olahem Ke'amorim. He saw that they were wearing a Beloris like the Amorim. Now the Amorim means the Amorites, but actually more correctly it's more like the Greeks and the Romans, okay? This case, but you know, sometimes they use fancier language because of censorship. Okay, mustn't forget that the Talmud faced censorship in Europe where they started to print it. Okay, and since the Roman Catholic Church was in full sway at that particular point, so they sometimes would take the word Rome and change it instead to Canaanites, Amorium, whatever they think. Okay? But at any rate, the question is, what is a Bloris? Okay? So Bloris, the Romans, the Greeks, they had a custom that they would let the hair grow long over here in the back. And they would tie it with knots and everything else, okay? You know, like hippies today, you know. You can see, I mean, these kids wearing long hair and so on and so on. So they would tie it, you know, with ponytails and stuff like that. And then, at a certain stage in their life, they would give an opsheren. Sort of parallel. They would cut it off, and then they would dedicate it to the Avodah Zarah. Okay? So he saw that they were wearing these ducktails or ponytails, whatever you want to call it, and he knew that eventually this would be dedicated to Avodah Zarah. And so this is the reason why he cursed them, okay? Rabbi Yochanan Amar, another interpretation. He saw that there wasn't even the tiniest flow of mitzvah within them. Lachluchis, of course, means like, you know, wetness, but it refers, for example, you know, like the sap of a tree, or let's say the marrow of a bone, you understand? But he saw that there wasn't even the slightest trace of a mitzvah in Lachluchis. This is what it was. So Deon, the Gemara, however, says the following, V'dilna b'zarayu nevei hava. But perhaps if he had not cursed them, so even if they themselves were so void of mitzvahs, but what about the fact that maybe a future generation could have been born to them that would, observe mitzvahs? So Rabbi Lozer, said, Lo bom, lo bizarum, and so forth. He saw that neither they nor any future descendants would actually ever observe mitzvahs to the end of time. Alright, now getting back to the story of the bears. The bear story, okay? Alright. So the Pasuk then says that two bears came out of the forest, but and they ripped apart, okay, they, in other words, they killed 42 children, okay.
So now we have to determine, first of all, about the bears in the forest, okay? And then we'll go back to 42. So Rav and Shmuel. So machloikas between Rav and Shmuel, how do you interpret it?
Well,
on the top of Mem Zion.
Yeah,
on top of Mem Zion now, okay? Chad Omar, one says that Nes, it was a miracle. The fact that you had, you know, bears or a forest. The Chad Omar, Nes Pesoch Nes. And the other one says actually it was a double miracle, because the question is first of all about the bears, and secondly about the forest. All right, and they'll explain. Man the Omar Nes, according to the one who says that it was a miracle, so he says Ya'ar Hava, so the Taka was a forest, you know, but Dubim Loi Havu, but there were no bears, so that the miracle was that suddenly bears came from there. Manda Omar, but the one who says Neis Besok Neis, he says Lo Ya'ar Hava Lo Bubim Havu, right, it was, there was neither a forest nor were there any bears. Okay. By the way, this became a proverbial expression, like Dubim Lo Ya'ar, right? In other words, is, you know, Nishke Shtegen, Nishke Flegen, you know, right? As we would say in Yiddish, you know, the story, you know, that it never happened, right?
Mm.
So then the Gemara, using Gemara Lashon would be like Dubim Lo Ya'ar. Okay. So this is the origin of that. Okay. So now the Gemara says, "Velehve dubim velehve yar." What if there are only bears, but there was no forest? Then what? So the answer is, "Dibeisei." If that's the case, then they would have been frightened away. Meaning who? The bears would have been frightened, because if you know there was no forest, the bears would have been frightened away because they didn't want to come in contact with human beings. Okay, that's probably what it means. However, we could take it the other way around. The Be'isei maybe means that, you know, these kids would have been scared had they, you know, if there was no forest, they saw bears suddenly, so they would have seized, they would have run away. So take your pick. All right. Omer Rabbi Chanina, now how about the 42? Omer Rabbi Chanina, said, B'shvil arboi mishtayim kobono shehikru balak melech moav, hufkum yisrael arboi mishtayim yidodim. Okay? You know why 42? He says, because Balak, the king of Moab, actually sacrificed 42 sacrifices. Remember, you know, when he hired Bilaam?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, Bilaam tells him, build 7 altars and so on, and have 7 burnt offerings, and then he takes them again someplace, and then takes them again someplace, and so on. So finally it comes up to a total of 42 different sacrifices that Balak sacrificed. So because he sacrificed this is why 42 young people died, because to a certain extent, in other words, the curse that Bilaam had put on the people of Israel was fulfilled in this particular case. So the Gemara says, Eini, is that so? Omar Rav Yehuda, didn't Rav Yehuda say, Omar Rav, the name of Rav, the Yolim Yasek, or the material mitzvahs, that a person should always engage in Torah and mitzvahs, the Yafal Pi Shalolishma, and even though it is not for the actual sake of learning, knowledge, but you're doing it, let's say, for some ulterior purpose, but nevertheless, Shemitok Shalolishma, Bolishma, very famous statement, by the way. Because the expectation is that even if you do it with an ulterior motive, but eventually you'll come to do it out of the pure love of learning Torah. Because as a reward for the 42 sacrifices that Balak, the king of Moab, sacrificed, Zocha, he merited the Yotzeso Mimenu Rus, that he should have a descendant Ruth, She Yotzeso Mimenu Shlomo, from whom Solomon even was descended. Of course, I mean, David and Solomon came from Ruth, right? She Klosev Bey,
In the case of Shlomo, what is written over there? It says, Elef Olos Ya'aleh Shlomo. That Shlomo sacrificed 1,000 burnt offerings. V'yoma Rabbi Yossi ben Choni, Rabbi Yossi ben Choni said, Rus Bito Shel Eglon. It says that Ruth was the daughter of Eglon. Eglon was the king of Moab, what we find in the early pages of the book of Shoftim. And to get back to the story of Eglon, it's written over there that there's a man by a Jew by the name of Ehud ben Gera, okay? And Eglon was rather severe upon the Jewish people. And so Ehud wanted to save the Jewish people, and he decided that he was going to kill Eglon. But how did he do it? So the answer is, he came to the palace of Eglon, and he said to Eglon, I have a message from God. And when Eglon heard that God was sending a message, so he stood up, and then he was slain. But the point is, as a reward of the fact that he showed respect for God, therefore he was worthy enough that eventually Ruth should be descended from him. So again, what do we see? That if you show respect for God, it carries a reward. Even a goy who shows respect for God will also be rewarded. Okay? And, let's see. We finish over here. Okay. And really it concludes funny. This little area by saying, Hoyesot Havoso Miholik Lolahab. Which means, but nevertheless, it says, all right, Ruth was the daughter of Eglon, who in turn was the son of Balak. Okay? So it says, but nevertheless, I mean, you're talking about, the fact that Balak was rewarded by the death of 42 people, right? But nevertheless, Hoyesot Havoso Miho Niklola says, nevertheless, he had the intention, he had the desire, however, to curse the Jewish people. Niklola Havan. Okay. Let's see. Let's see. We'll wait a little bit more and then we'll call it on. Vayomer Anshei Ha'ir El Elisha. So the people of the city said to Elisha, he said, Hineinu Moshav Ha'ir Tov. Look, he says, place where we live is a good place. Kasher Adoni Roe, as you, literally our Lord, as you can see. Of course, again, the people of Yericho are saying this. You know, that's when they were complaining about the fact that the water is no good, but nevertheless they say, but this is such a nice place, we like this place, okay? So the Gemara says, V'chimi achar demayim royim, di'eretz mishakeles. Take a look, he says, the water is no good over there, right? And the land, obviously, without water, what does it do? It cannot sustain its inhabitants. So tell me, how good could it be over there that they say that it's a good place to live in? So Amar Rabbi Chonon said, Chayim Mokam Ad Yoshva, says that when people live in a place, there is a loyalty, there is a certain beauty that they find in the place where they live. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan said then, Shlosha Chinos Hein. He says there are three different types of favor or love that you can find. Chein Mokam Al Yoshvav, right, as we said before, namely that people enjoy the place where they are living. Chein Isha al Baalo, a husband finds love for his wife, right? And Chein Mekach al Mikho, and when a person buys something, he's very happy with what he buys. And he likes what he buys, okay? Okay. Well, I think I'm going to stop over here tonight, and we'll continue with the story of Elisha.
And we go into the story about Elisha and Gehazi, and so on and so forth. Oh, yeah. All right, because my throat frankly feels a little bit strained at this point.
Okay,
yeah. So next week in the Tzachon, we shall continue from this point.
Okay.
Just want to point out.
Where are we finishing up now?
We're on Mem Zion Amud Aleph.
Okay.
And if you'll take a look, you see we're not so far from the end already. Because how many Dapim are there? Mem Tes. So in other words, in a few weeks, we should be able to make a
Siyum
on this. So we'll have to discuss this further in terms of two things. I mean, first of all, what would we like to continue learning? And secondly, as always, we've made a scene with a dinner, and I'll have to talk to JD and so on,
right,
so I have a better idea of the
very good
date. Okay?
Should be an occasion.